Ladies and gentlemen,
tonight is Bob Layson, who's going to talk on Hayek. What is it?
The precise title.
What's it precise is Hayek, Austrian Economics, and the Place of Ignorance in the Market Order.
And much needed will it be.
As a humorous overture, I should point out that having thought of this title last night, I emailed it to David McDonough. And he sent me back a thank you saying, fine. Then I read what I'd sent. And it said, the place of ignorance in the market order. Now, that's not an example of ignorance, because I know how to spell ignorance. On the other hand, since I hadn't noticed that I'd misspelled ignorance, it could be a case of ignorance. This will not be explained in what follows. Well, it may be. 30 years ago, I bought this book. Well, not quite though. 8th of the 12th century 9. Hayek. Which contains a famous essay, amongst other famous essays. The Use of Knowledge in Society. Yes, The Use of Knowledge in Society. Which has had great repercussions. It has given birth to a great deal of useful analysis and interpretation. And I intend to add something to it. I should give an aside here on scholarship. I don't knock scholarship. I rather enjoy the scholarship of others, even myself when I get it right. But what I've always liked is getting the ideas out and discussing them. Doesn't matter who said it first. Doesn't matter if the person you attributed it to didn't quite say it like that. Doesn't matter if he wouldn't recognise it in broad daylight or repudiate it. The point is, is it true? Is it useful? Does it help? Now, Rothbard, a chap I much admire for getting the ideas out and discussing them, reckoned himself as something as a scholar. Others don't, but I could forgive him. Because at least he pointed you towards the texts, so you could always go and work it out yourself. But I like the ideas up front and out, so I won't be acknowledging too much of the work of other people, because, I mean, I claim no originality at all. If I'm original, despite myself, then I will bask in the glory. Here we go. Now, beginning a bit with, as I should do with Hayek, he was of course part of the economic calculation argument, ongoing ruckus between those who still insisted upon it. I'm not sure the Soviets did much in this regard, but American academics certainly did, and they thought there were ways of by simultaneous equations and or playing markets, setting prices, requiring firms to adjust, requiring firms to set to marginal cost, finding out what happened to their suppliers going up or down. And we don't need the market, because as Mises pointed out, they're going to play market, but playing market isn't quite good enough. And also, that could be our chairman. And also, as others have pointed out, what was the point in all this communist upheaval? What was the point of all the misery and the class war if you end up requiring people to adjust just as much and take the wages that they're going to get just as much within a socialist market system as within the real one? What was the point? Is it going to be that much more productive? Well, that's perhaps they might have claimed that, but you have to allow for all the misery of getting there in the short run. However, Mises and Hayek, he's a student, pushed the economic calculation argument, which is that even with the best will in the world, which is possibly not going to be there anyway, you wouldn't know what to do for best without market prices. Decisions regarding capital could not be made. I mean, it's obvious you can choose capital that, other things being equal, does better than other capital. I mean, for the same weight of tin or metal or same number of hours of labour, if one system turns out more things are valued than the other, then you would choose that. But that's not the answer. That's not part of the answer. It's no answer at all, in fact. Although the Soviet Union ground on for another 60, 70, 80 years, they never really answered any of this. They had, in fact, not failed socialism. Well, they tried the so-called period of war communism. But after a while, they simply had private property again, although in a strange kind of collegiate manner, rather like every factory was a monastery, where the manager couldn't really own anything, but he disposed of things, and they had a man on the side, a fixer, who would go and buy stuff here and there, so they could turn out things on the side that the people wanted, and also meet their planned target. In fact, they endeavoured to overfulfill their requirements, just so they could get bonus points. So that's Hayek, one of our Mises. But Hayek thought he would go further and say there's a much broader explanation for why this must go wrong, which is that the knowledge that the planner, the central planner, is supposed to make use of or have somehow, he has first to acquire. And this knowledge is simply not the sort of knowledge that can be phoned in, put down on paper, be a matter of statistics. Much of this knowledge is a matter of time and place. Knowing where to go if that's not there, or what happened the last time that happened, or I know a chap who... All these things are done every day of the week, every hour of the day, in the market order. And the idea that you can be just as efficient without doing the same, one way or the other, with a planned system, is, well, how can this be? Why is the market doing it? I've set aside ideas that it's just doing daft things, so you wouldn't have to do those. I'll put that to one side. So Hayek said that there is tacit knowledge, there is implicit knowledge, there's knowledge of time and place, there's personal knowledge that simply cannot be gathered together. Knowledge is not given. It's always given. Given the knowledge, then we set the simultaneous equations to work. Now, of course, they couldn't even do that. But thanks to computers, it looks less laughable now. But the idea that you simply know where everything is, you know what you want to do, and despite not knowing what mix of capital you should use, you could work out the production plan, who's got to do what, by how much, using what materials and labour. And Hayek's point has been taken up in the Austrian school and made a great deal of. Now, this is where my bad scholarship comes. I think somewhere, possibly the man himself, who at other times was saying how prices provide knowledge, prices provide information, prices tell you this, prices tell you that, he also said that prices mean, or having a price system means that you don't have to know. And I think that's the far more profound point. That you don't have to know what it means when the price of copper goes up. I mean, you may have to. Chaps in your firm might try and hedge on it. They might try and anticipate future prices. You might consider substitutes for copper when the price of copper goes up. But you don't have to know why it's going up particularly. It's not telling you anything. It's not telling you how long it will last. It's not telling you what to do. It's something you have to adjust to. Yes, it's something you have to bear in mind. But it's not providing knowledge in itself, I don't think. Except the bare knowledge of what the price of copper is, what it has been, which doesn't tell you a great deal about the future, necessarily, without expectations about the future. So I don't know whether Hayek would have acknowledged just as much, but just in case he didn't, I think this is somewhat missing the point. That the existence of other agents, of other prices, other price setters, price takers, price givers, other firms, means that, well, I don't know how they make it, but I know what it costs and I know when they can deliver it. And I know that they can deliver this much at this price, that much at that price, and if they don't, then we go there and we can sue the pants off them if they don't, whatever it might be. So the advantage of the market order is that you only have to know what the prices pretty much are. Be fairly confident they're going to not change too much, or if they do, in the favour of yourself, because the cost may fall but the selling price may maintain itself. So that's the kind of knowledge which doesn't even require knowledge too much. It's your local knowledge is good enough. You don't have to have economy-wide knowledge. You don't have to have the kind of rational expectations, which is a school of economics whereby everybody knows what's going to happen because everyone expects everyone else to be rational and to have the same theory of how the economy works. It seems to be ludicrous, but it's done rather well for itself. Only because it was getting away from something even sillier, which was the Keynesian view of the matter, where expectations, although he, to be fair to him, he did use expectations a fair bit, in other respects, things didn't change much. Only the capitalist, only the entrepreneur investor had these Dark Nights of the Soul, had these tipping points whereby he would be cease to be optimistic and plunge into pessimism for no good reason at all, and the whole thing would go tits up, to use a technical term. That's there. At this point I thought, well, I'd read around the subject, I'd read other Oxygenes, I admired Hayek enormously, of course, but I thought there must be more, so I found Lachman and others and enjoyed their stuff. They thought they were rather close to Keynes, and dangerously close, because other Austrians tut-tut and say you can't find anything good in the poor man, even his moustache, or his prose style possibly, but nothing else. No, I don't think the man was a charlatan. I don't think he was a fool. I think he was wrong. It happens to the best of us, not myself, of course. I don't think, but it happens to the best of people. So there's plenty of goodwill out there, there's plenty of intelligence, but it's possible to get it wrong, and I think Keynes did. So without being a mere Keynes basher, though he has to in the end to be bashed with regret, not for being a bad person or an appalling moral relativist or not believing in the truth, as some, like Rothbard, who gave a sort of sixth form talk that I listened to the other day, simply knocking the poor man here and there, but he can't answer for himself. I mean, he wasn't a complete fool. He didn't disbelieve in the future. He didn't care whether we're all dead or not in the future, because we can live it up now. He did, protesting against the Victorians, as the Bloomsbury set did, if he could find a way of poking them in the eye, he would. And rather, as many a religion has done, he has said people work so hard, strive so hard to have a good life in the future, they have a poor life in reality, up to the point in which they never get to the future, in which they're supposed to live and enjoy all their savings and enjoy all their treasure piled up. And there's something in that. There's something in that. But that's not economic. That's more on the line of philosophy or religion. In Shacklin and others, I came to the idea of market failure, but not in the sense of a failure of aggregate demand, but simply the inevitable failure of markets, because you simply don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what your competitor's up to. You don't know what the fashion is going to do the next week. You're not entirely sure about the cost of supplies, therefore there will be failure. But will it be a failure of plans? Not general plans, we've put those aside as impossible. Actually, they are impossible even to write out. It's certainly impossible to see if they're being followed. So even in a command economy, you don't know if your commands are being followed. You don't know what commands you should give in the fine detail. So we end up with an authoritarian state to stop people rejecting the command economy, but beyond that you allow this kind of messy kind of vaguely market order with a great deal of real market on the side, very efficient but very small, like the private plots under the communist system and the things that were made in the last hour of the day that could actually be sold. So any raw materials and things you could nick or make use of at work, you actually made something the public wanted and sold it, but that was done on privately, that wasn't part of the firm's output. So I'm thinking more of the firms of plans, of the plans of individuals. What to do with them? They can't always succeed, you know this. Do they always clash? Well, governments often claim that there is a clash of value, but there has to be some reconciliation. There has to be a middle way. Somewhere has to be invented, somewhere has to be subsidised. Because values clash. Now my view is that values can't clash any more than square roots can clash. They're just there. But even plans can't clash if you have correctly if you are the correct owner, the actual owner of some property, if you actually contract it with someone to use their property in such and such a way, at such a date, in such a place, then your plan can go through. It can be thwarted in a criminal manner, but providing everyone is doing as they legally may, or what is legally theirs, the plans cannot fail, in one sense of fail. In the sense of making a profit, it's, of course you can fail. But the whole point with a profit is that there's sufficient freedom in the system, so that once you've followed your plan through, the customer may say, and move on. So you can plan everything as an entrepreneur, but the sales, you can plan to back themselves up if they do well, you can plan to But if it said it won't shift, you have to change your plan. As a ship's captain once said to me, it's very important to make a plan, stick to it, and change it later. which is what people do. So plans actually carried through to completion, in one sense, always work. That's what it's almost by definition, because you've done it to completion. You may have to change the plan all the way along, at each stage getting more and more miserable about the likely outcome, but the plan has gone all the way through. These plans are compossible. A friend of mine thought that compossible wasn't a word, but I said it is a word. I got it from Leibniz. He may have got it from mathematics, because he was a great mathematician, but I got it from the philosophy side, which means that all these plans actually carried out do integrate. And the best plans, if everyone knew what to do in each firm, would perfectly integrate, and you would have the average return on capital, your costs would be covered, your interest would be paid, and there'd be no profits. That's another way of viewing perfect general equilibrium. There are no profits. There are returns to the entrepreneur as a manager, or as the owner of a good idea, possibly. But that's the general equilibrium, which I think to be impossible and not desirable. I also don't think, and this is where we get closer to the nihilist or far too radical subjectivists such as Shackle and Lachman, who don't think that the economy tends towards equilibrium. I mean, households may do, firms may do. Individuals may say, I've had enough of that, I'll go on to that. Or I can't think what to do for now, I'll just sit here. There's that kind of equilibrium. But at a general level across the economy, there is not general equilibrium, and it's not particularly desirable that there should be, because that means there's no innovation, there are no new ideas, there's nothing coming on that no one else has thought of. So some Misesians and others think that what Mises calls the evenly rotating economy, which is another word for general equilibrium, is useful as a teaching aid or as an aid to thought, to say that's what you would get to if every good idea was followed up and no new ideas came to mind. Well, okay, I don't mind. But it encourages the mathematicians out there. And I have to own up, I'm not a mathematician, I don't like it, but I've made a virtue of my failing, and discovered very good reasons why mathematics is of not much use in economics. I'd like to have it as well, but I don't think I like to think I wouldn't use it particularly, because the important thing is to know what the institution should be for the most productive and free market system, and then to argue for them and have them, not to use the mathematics, which I find I don't do. The mathematics is especially poor at covering the idea of someone having a good idea or an insight. I mean, what's the mathematics of seeing a riddle? There might be some, but as far as I know, brains, these systems that see the answers to riddles, just flop into them. They don't, like, you can say there's some kind of subconscious calculating going on, but I don't know if there is. But I won't hang too much on that, because it might be that I'm wrong. It might be that there is a kind of...
There's mathematics in virtually anything.
Well, yeah, quite. Yes, yes. Point is, I don't employ it. I don't see the need to employ it. So we have plans. Plans that are compossible. In fact, when they're carried out, they are... I mean, someone has a plan to make a fortune, and then has a plan to sell his factory to the scrap merchant. I mean, it's still a plan, and it's one he carries through to successful. He didn't want to do so, but he has to do so. So... With the private property system, one of its advantages is that there's no real clash. There's clashes of opinion. I mean, there are different values, but there's no reason why the things actually carried out should clash. I mean, two chats may wish for the hand of a lady, but, or another chap possibly. But they don't get it. But their plan isn't thwarted. Their expectations are dashed possibly. Their plan was they dress up, they smile, they play the banjo, they. You know, whatever it might be, to win the heart, but they don't get it. I mean, all the plans are carried through, but the desired result is not got. So we have plans, but they're not just stabs in the dark. This much of Mises and Hayek is perfectly correct. You use the prices as a starter. You don't make something which, on the face of it, no one wants. It's very expensive to make, and the prices keep going up, and the selling price is going down. Now, you don't do those things unless it's a make work stimulus scheme, but we'll come to that. So the prices and the sales of others, the methods of others, are there to guide you. As at least you've got to do better than that. You've got to have a method better than that, or use that method plus better product, plus better advertising, plus better placement, whatever it might be. So prices are very handy for that. You often hear loose talk. It's nearly always loose talk, actually, of coordination, integration. But it's never said what this means. Now, as I've said already, plans do integrate, but it might be thought it's better to have no unsuccessful plans. That's just waste. I mean, although even in a communist system, well, perhaps more there, nothing actually reduces utterly useless, unless you believe these one-ton buttons that were made. I don't believe that. Just to meet the requirements of the plan, and buttons were done by weight, so you make one big button. And that. No, I don't believe that. Though apparently Soviet furniture was very big and heavy, and that may have been by the ton of output. So that may have been the reason. So few things are actually useless, because you'll remember you're making it for a customer. You have to at least know what the sort of thing they want. So at worst, it's overpriced, or it's not so attractive, or it's not the fashion. So at least in the market economy, most things are useful, but that's not the point. The point is the opportunity cost of making less useful things. You could have made more useful things. So how are we going to do it? Now, this is where the ignorance comes in. You're not quite sure. You look around, you see what others are doing. Think of a new scheme, try it out, but you don't know whether it's going to work. In that respect, there's ignorance. Also, since you're all searching for a good product or a low-cost method of production, people who search all over a field to find something, many of them are guaranteed not to find it, because it's there. And that person finds it. Now, that's only an analogy, but it's rather like that with business. So we have to have search, there will be failure, and there is inevitable ignorance. But new methods are found, new ways are found, new techniques are found, and they're adopted, copied, and then eventually surpassed and thrown aside. So it's a kind of social Darwinism, horror, but I don't mean national Darwinism, I don't mean state Darwinism, I don't mean racial or genetic Darwinism, just a kind of Darwinism of methods. And some argue that everything's a matter of knowledge. I mean, a lathe is just so much knowledge of how to cut metal using a machine. So some have argued that way. You can actually make everything just a matter of knowledge, and then improving knowledge, acquiring knowledge. So it's important to have a system whereby you're not simply, coming back to the general equilibrium, you're not simply doing everything as best you may and wasting nothing. Someone's had a good idea. And the good idea will quite spoil the success, and maybe even cause much plan changing. For example, when coal came cheaply to Newcastle, not Newcastle, to Manchester from Worsley, because the Duke of whoever it was had built a canal, him and his money and Bridgewater. I'm not sure if he had shareholders as well. They very often did after that. But the point is, it was far too good a canal. It's still there. It's all stone lined. It's far too good. But being the only one, it wasn't too good in a sense, because it made things so much cheaper that there was a great demand to use it. So coal arrived in Manchester, which means that many things that use coal could now be made more cheaply, and things that were never made before could be made, houses could be warmer, all that kind of thing. Now that shook the market up. It certainly didn't maintain a general equilibrium. I'm not sure it actually moved towards a general equilibrium. I don't really care. The point is, it made people who knew their business suddenly realise they didn't quite know their business anymore. So the important thing is not to know things, but to find out better things. And that's what market competition does. It's rather like with science, which sadly is going the way of a kind of Soviet system. Why? I mean, imagine if you were allowed one experiment per year. The scientists all had to decide which experiment in each discipline, or a list of 100 experiments, and they then would get the money. No, that would be appalling. It's like saying they should only give all the money to people who are modelling the climate. Oh, no, they are, aren't they? some degree working on that basis. So it's much better to allow cranks, millionaires, people who've saved a bit, to go into things that they think might work, and they're not quite sure, but they do, and they're followed up, and the idea spread. So that's plans. I said plans have to integrate. Coordination is adjusting to what innovations or cost changes or demand changes from the consumer have done. That's a kind of coordination. There's integration between firms. You're not all isolated producers. So we have plans, coordination, integration. But integration is not simply having firms, because it requires something there beforehand, which are institutions. So it's vital they have to be the right laws, or sufficiently not wrong laws and institutions as we have in this country, practices. It's important whether you have limited liability companies or not. Some libertarians differ on this. Whether there should be partnerships. I mean, for a while, workers' associations, they had no recourse to law if someone ran off with a cash box. I believe that's how it worked. So, obviously, the law has to make possible all manner of institutions. Now we've dealt with plans, coordination, integration, profit and value. That's a matter of costs and what the customer sees. Is there a model underlying all of this? Well, no, I don't much care for models, unless it's an exact scale model. It was the model of St. Paul's. Lovely thing. It didn't look nothing like the finished article, actually. So it wasn't really a model of St. Paul's, was it? Christopher Wren wanted an exactly symmetrical cruciform circle and equal length cross parts, but he wasn't allowed to have that. He had to have a nave, so he gave them a nave. So models are, unless they're exact models and merely scaled up, most models are not that at all. They're vastly simplified. It's thought that in science you have to simplify, you have to abstract in order to understand what's going on. At this point, there's a vague waving towards friction or air friction in ballistics, and then you move on. You don't really explain what you're doing. You just want to get the maths in again instead of understanding what's going on, which I thought might be more important. But now you want to get the maths in, so you simplify. You have one commodity world, worlds where everyone sees the next good idea or the next truth, or knows everyone else's prices, or everyone knows the next move. I mean, there are economists who make use of this, and I'm sure in a way it's very useful, but I'd rather understand what's going on. I know they think it's going to help, but I don't. I don't see the poster models. I think you can have an understanding which would apply to many market economies once they're of a certain size, with the sort of people they're likely to be in any market economy, rather like a kind of sort of Kantian idea, which is it's true for all possible market orders, without having to spell out all the details. I mean, providing you have agents. This is why Mises is a bit hard done by. It's thought that he's just telling everyone what must happen with apodictic certainty. You know, because from his a priori armchair, he can just tell how the world will work. He's not really saying that at all. He's saying if there is scarcity, if there are actors, agents, individuals will value this rather than that. If there is work, if there is a leisure preference, if there's a disutility of labour, if money has emerged, or a commodity used as money has emerged, then certain things follow. And I think that's entirely fair. Doesn't mean you can't test it against reality. You can test it logically. You can also say if it actually works. I mean, what effect does a rent? Does rent control have? What effect does a minimum wage have? I don't see any objection to looking and seeing. But I do think that you can say things about all possible market economies and be accurate and right without having to actually identify each particular part. So I think you can have an analysis that allows for all the detail, doesn't have to come down to something simple, and then add in the world later, or as much as your mathematics can take. I think you can have all the world, and it's buzzing confusion and difficulty, but you simply won't identify everything, you won't itemize everything, but it's there. Rather like if you're thinking of ship design, how a ship will behave in a waterway in a storm. You know, the metacentric height and the, you know, the rules of buoyancy and the rest of it. But you can discount, in some sense, the exact pattern of the waves. Waves being a sort of aquatic, chaotic system, I believe, such that it's not actually predictable what all the waves will do in a certain day with the wind. But you know vaguely what they're going to do, not too much, to sink the ship. So there's, you know, the ship's either going to pitch or it's going to roll. No, hang on, it's going to pitch or it's going to roll. Or a combination of the two, it's corkscrewing. So a great many, a multitude of forces can be understood as resulting in this, quite straightforward thing. So a multitude of forces would result in profits, loss, bankruptcy court, mergers. So in other words, you can allow the complexity to be there because you know that it works itself out as you're either wearing a hat or not. You're either profitable or not. I think you see the point. I should say something about opportunities. I dealt with models and abstractions and the results of unknown activities. Again, referring to an earlier point, you don't have to know what's going on, but you can see from the net result that someone somewhere is making a better product than you, the swine. I dealt with ignorance and the acquisition of knowledge and practical know-how, another, the knowledge of time and place, which is Hayek's point. I dealt with search and inevitable failure. It's important, of course, to have incentives to make you want to search and make improvements. No, I don't like the mere, again, loose talk of incentives. It implies that the only important thing is that these ghastly people should be allowed enough of their own money to get them to turn up for work and manage. The most important thing is there should be freedom of capital to invest. So, and as well, the returns to the entrepreneur, but there should also must be the returns to the investor. And if you keep shaving it off, oh, where's he going to invest? State bonds. He has no choice. At this point, I should deal with the idea that some, such as Shackle and Hayek, not Hayek, Shackle and Lachman, who are impressed by this part of Keynes, that he allows for simply changes of heart, of spirit, as I've said, of differing expectations about the future. It's thought that this doesn't give him very much ground at all. It just explains how things can lurch about, but they generally lurch about because some clown has debauched the currency by having an artificially low interest rate for the past 5 years. And that's the sort of thing that mucks the economy up. Beyond that, I don't see the sort of lurches around that we have in the interventionist economy. I mean, there'll be changes of fashion. There'll be, as I said, with the cost of coal in Manchester, there'll be innovations that disrupt the market in one sense. They'll give all sorts of opportunities to make profits and also to make better things, more things, cheaper things. So there's that kind of uncertainty. The uncertainty is whether your plan will, even your integrated plan, even your coordinated integrated plan, will actually make you a winner or a loser. There's that uncertainty. And that's been held against people such as Shackle and Lachman. They're nihilists. I mean, they're weak reads. They don't give a gung-ho justification for the market system, which I think they do, but they just acknowledge certain truths about it. It doesn't make it inefficient. If there's no other way of being efficient but looking for efficiency and sometimes failing, then that's pretty good, I should have thought. However, although there is ignorance in some measure about the future, such that it might give an investor pause for thought, though I like, as I've said, most of the jolts or shocks to the system come from government intervention. In other ways, a market system is the most dependable, the most... well, you know you can get a square meal somewhere in Paris on a Friday night, for example. That's the idea. There's uncertainty regarding some particulars, but as you move further up in generality, is that restaurant I saw 20 years ago still there? They made a wonderful such and such. Well, no, it's not there. They don't make it. Well, it's there and they don't make it anymore. All right. Is that street full of restaurants still there? Well, no, it's now a motorway, but there are others. Can I get a meal? Yes. Yes. And this applies to a great many other, all other things. If you're, unless you're, the one particular thing you wanted, and that's not like a lottery ticket. Can I buy a lottery ticket? Yeah. Can I buy the winner? Well, in one sense of can, you can buy the winner. But someone else has got it, which you can't. But the market order is very dependable, very reliable in many ways, even though you may lose your job, even though you may lose your investment, in which case you should be adaptable and don't invest in one thing at a time, perhaps. Unless it works. So even though there is necessary ignorance about the future, even about the past, then, ignorance doesn't mean that you can't advocate the system where they must be inevitable ignorant, because it is very dependable when it comes to getting certain things. Firms engage in division of labour, but also specialist production, and also specialist production using universal systems, such that you make something, but the user uses a certain type of nut and bolt that can be used by another firm in another way. In other words, the modern world is not bespoke so much, therefore all sorts of things you know will be out there. Even if your supplier goes under, you can do this, you can do that. Sometimes capital is so specific for one purpose that you can't shift it, you won't sell for scrap, you can't do a thing with it, but it was worth it, because had it worked, it would have made you a fortune perhaps. So I don't see any nihilism in advocating market institutions, even though there's a great deal of uncertainty about particular outcomes, particular folk, or about future prices, or future types of product, because you know in a more general sense that food is to be had, a good night out is to be had, a bed is to be had, where it might be. You get the grand finale. As the American humorist Will Rogers is reputed to have said, it's not ignorance that does the harm, it's people knowing so much that ain't so. In other words, if we didn't have a clue and then set to work to think about it, that might help. Although in a Popperian sense you have to have one hypothesis to replace it with another. But the point is that humans, and perhaps all thinking beings would... No, I'll take that back. At least as regards humans, we always have an answer. Oh, it's God. It's global warming. It's them atom bombs, as I heard an old lady say when I was a boy. Them atom bombs, that's what does it. So we always advance an answer to things. We have a theory for almost everything, however inadequate. We're not prepared to say, oh, I don't really know about that. But the theory has to get tested and can be replaced by a superior one. So there's hope there. I mean, ants have a great act, in a sense, but they haven't changed it for I don't know how many billion years. They're doing the same old shtick as they always did. It works, but it's hard to say they actually think. I mean, they might be frozen thoughts, in a sense, or plans that provide a sort of rationale for the various functions each performs, but they're not thinking. But they're not thinking. No, certainly. Yes. So the danger of ignorance is rather that we proceed upon knowledge that we don't allow either to be tested or to be avoided, which brings us to the present economics, the great stimulus and other laughable carryings on. Where are we? I must read you this bit. Although I admire the man, though I haven't read all his books, John Updike, literary man of letters, not the same thing. Really, the talk's over. This is just a nice ending. It tells where we are, and that the arguments must go on. That it's not market failure out there, although some bankers have been rather foolish, I think. But the real failure of international banking is the failure of the system of international state banks, which Gordon Brown has not apologised for or acknowledge any fault. We've had a market system with non-market money. Liberals have been far too kind in a way. They're far too kind on state money and state education. They think, oh, well, it can be made good enough. It can be made good enough, providing we have no tariffs. We can manage. But I think that has been far too kind. It should have been laid into for believing in state education, and certainly believing in state money. When it was just gold, perhaps. But since then, they should have said, no, it must be utterly non-political, commercially provided money. That way, we would have one money around the world. It might have different names associated with it in different countries. It may have the king's head on it, or some famous hero or other, on the coins or on the notes. But there really would be just one world money. I mean, these coins or notes would exchange usually at 2-1, 4-1, 1.5-1, whatever it might be. So the world would be much better off with a commercially provided single world money, which worldwide branch banks, free banks, would issue in such a way that we wouldn't get the pro-business, pro-growth, low interest rates, followed by the high interest rates to save the currency, followed by low interest rates to save, I don't know what, win an election, followed by high interest rates to save the currency again, followed by low interest rates to go bloody hell, the whole thing's melting down. Let's have no interest rates. Let's have the lowest interest rates. I'm a saver, thanks to my father. The lowest interest rates in 16, whatever it was, 85. It could be argued that in the 70s, because of inflation, there were actually more negative interest rates than now.
No one could have forecast all this.
No. We did. Anyway, so we'll finish with a laugh. From although in a way you have to say, well, it's heartfelt. But it's sad to see intelligent people not getting to the right answer. What's the point being intelligent if you don't get to the right answer? I mean, as I said earlier, we can all be wrong. But if the arguments are out there, at least encounter them. At least see whether you're right or wrong. John Updike. My father had been reared a Republican, but he switched parties to vote for Roosevelt and never switched back. His memory of being abandoned by society and big business never left him. And for all his paternal kindness and humorousness communicated itself to me, along with his preference for the political party that offered the forgotten man the better break. This is Democrats. Funnily enough, the forgotten man was the poor sap who paid all the taxes. It wasn't Joe Schmo who couldn't get a job. It was the man who got taxed and regulated. Roosevelt made people feel less alone, especially the Japanese. The impression of recovery, the impression that the president was bending the old rules and drawing upon his own courage and flamboyance in adversity and illness, well, we haven't had that yet with Obama, stirring things up on behalf of the down and out banker, car making industrialist, mattered more than any miscalculations in the moot mathematics and economics. Business is basically merciless, geared to maximise profit. Government is ultimately a humane transaction. And Roosevelt put a cheerful, defiant, caring face on government at a time when faith in democracy was ebbing throughout the Western world. For this inspirational feat, he is the 20th century's greatest president, to rank with Lincoln and Washington as a symbolic figure for a nation to live by. So we know what we're up against, by the way. Here's for Austrian economics.
Yeah?
Since the bankers are rather foolishly, surely the bankers looked at the rules and said, well, these are the rules, and we can do all these things, we can get away with it, we don't have to go to prison, worst comes to the worst.
What's the downside?
They've done it exactly.
Yes.
It was predictable that they would go, if I don't do it, this guy will, and he would, and he'll outcompete me. It's like blaming the unemployed, say, well, they're just like, no, they're not, they're making a rational economic decision. Work is irksome, and they're paid not to work.
And also, once everyone's paid to wait for good times to return, they don't. Because instead of bidding wages down or turning out produce, which is real demand isn't money, that's inflation, demand is produce, or services, which you have to make by reintegrating yourself somewhere else in the economy and earning a wage. I should say, though, that this is known as regulatory arbitrage, is a term the American Arnold Kling, I think, has used, saying that given we want to make a return, and given the way the taxes are slewed, let's do something more risky. He claims that the suits didn't know what the geeks knew. The geeks knew it was far more risky, and they had occasionally tried to tell the suits what was going on, but the suits were figureheads and and wouldn't hear it. So I don't know how much it's true, but certainly it was predictable that this would happen. Not quite as bad as this, perhaps, but
predictable as they get planned to
swap. True.
Morally, you can't say how shockingly immoral these bankers were. They were just operating within the rules.
Surely, if you have a system where they can do what they like, surely there's somebody else to be blamed. Maybe the government that developed the system that allowed them to do what they
do. Good point. I was reading a website today where someone said, if you're looking for systematic failure, what about the system of national banks and deficit financing and floating exchange rates sometimes and whopping on and off of tariffs and non-tariff barriers? I mean, there's a system, if you like, a system that was supposed to enable growth, which it did. Up a cul-de-sac.
What also worries me is everything that the government's doing at the moment is based on the assumption that we're going to have growth. At the moment, our resources are depleting. 1970, there were 3 billion people on the planet. There are now 6.2 billion people on the planet. And in 40 years' time, there'll be 12 billion people on the planet.
Ah.
So you're getting more.
I wish you were right. I have to
fewer resources.
And I wish you were right. I have to tell you. I have to tell you that it seems that every country, once it gets sufficiently wealthy, the birth rate collapses. Mm. So there's every chance that in 50 years, that the Earth's population will be declining. I think the more the merrier, because for every Hitler, there could be half a dozen Einsteins or at least clever clogs out there. But I mean, I don't. I take the what's his name?
Simon.
Yeah, the Julian Simon line that the pretty much the more the merrier. I mean, obviously there are imaginary circumstances where you're stuck on some island with one coconut tree and several fish, and that wouldn't make any sense. But when resources are simply what you find by thinking, what will make a good resource? What use can I make of that? I can't, in that sense, resources are infinite, in the sense that they can always, we can't see that they can't always be added to. In the sense that there's only so much coal in the world, that seems to be fixed. Well, even that, I doubt, because it was made before, it could be made again, though it would probably take too much energy to make it, which wouldn't be worth it. But no, I don't think that's the problem. Human ingenuity. You can't have a glut of that. You can't have too much of that. And there seems to be an awful lot about. And so that gets ploughed in. So, I mean, how much oil did the caveman have? Well, in a sense, none. He had no use for it. Some of them may have dragged things in tar pits and set fire to them, but aside from that, he didn't see the use of oil or coal, perhaps. Perhaps coal.
Well, I must admit, I've seen the electric car. 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds, 205 miles an hour.
Yeah, but it would take coal to charge it up at night.
Yeah, that's true.
I've forgotten what I was going to reply.
Yeah, where is this getting us?
Yes.
Which one?
I mean, 20 years ago, I was an optimist. To me that free market ideas were going to dominate and socialist ideas were going to fall away. And I think you could ask anybody in 1989, and it's almost exactly 20 years ago since you see the Berkeley film, Hayek would have been winning over Keynes, all sorts of things being privatised, however lamely, and certainly the socialism of the Soviet Union had failed and was seen to fail. However, it seems to be nearly 20 years. It seems to me to have gone backwards. Mm-hmm. And we have an idiot standing up there in front of Congress, wherever he was, who might actually get away with arguing. I mean, I'm not guaranteeing he's going to lose the next election. But this management of the world's economies is actually necessary, desirable, and will achieve good outcomes. And I don't know, is anyone in this room who does, how the hell can you persuade the people, the electorate, those who are thinking more sensibly, that what's happened for the last 150 years is a failure of government. It's a failure of governance everywhere. No particular government, I mean, this one is particularly socialist, but all governments are socialist around the world. There isn't a single free market government around. They've interfered with education, they've interfered with money, they've interfered with planning, they've interfered with absolutely everything. Every act that you can think of, you know, the Industrial Disputes Act mucked around that particular tort, the Race Relations Act, the Equal Opportunities Act, they've all been messing around with
sexual Congress, possibly not. Sexual positions. There's more freedom regarding sexual positions.
Give them some time. They
don't have to for what it's worth. I mean, it doesn't make up for the rest.
Maybe the word every would be better. Nearly every intervention has denied
it. I take your point, yes.
And it seems to me that we have a new concept of democracy, which is simply one man, one vote, which is progressively removing the old concept of democracy, which is people's rights. Now, how the hell does anyone get the whole world to understand that this movement towards ever-increasing government interference is just downright mistake?
Look on the bright side, it will end in tears. Mm. In a sense, it has to. it's going to be bloody awful. I mean, look on the bright side. We can be optimistic. The point is to be sufficiently available to have, as a mere irritant possibly, in America it's better, but at least someone saying this, like Ron Paul in America, about the money. There are people saying it won't work, it can't work, this is how we got here. Now, at present, they're marginalised because we're going to use the tried and trusted methods that failed in the 30s. But as long as there's someone, a blessed remnant, who are actually saying what will happen what should have happened, there's a chance. You can't. Sometimes you go from, you know, Imperial Rome to eventually a somewhat.
I'm being pessimistic about that.
Different so time.
Shut me up if I talk too much. I mean, 3 months ago, there were people saying, oh, we're saying it. But it seems to me a consensus has emerged. I mean, even Janet Daly, who writes sensible stuff in the Telegraph from time to time,
has
to succumb to this thing.
Succumb
to this idea that it's wicked bankers, that the government has gone along with this, aided and abetted it, and the failure of proper regulation is the cause of all this. And it's actually Daly what he's saying. Hang on a minute, this is entirely caused by governments. I mean, you're making the point over there, I'm not sure I accept your moral point, but these bankers had no choice in a sense. If you inflate the economy, someone will cause bad things to happen and the bubble will burst.
Well, no, it was held against them it was held against firms if they didn't get into debt. But, you know, the tax advantages of getting into debt, come on.
I can't remember his name, but somebody got sacked, didn't he,
yes.
Saying that it was not a good idea to invest in all these high risk things.
No.
Stephen Barry.
The analogy I've used on this is rather like the government or the central banks greasing all the roads with oil. Some car drivers predictably go too quickly and crash, and then we have to find out what the problem was, and everybody starts blaming the car drivers. No one blames the people who grease the roads. So that's my analogy. I think it's fair. But what this fellow here says is quite right. I'm amazed, given that the 1970s, the Keynesian recipes were so spotted, the results were so spotted. I can remember everybody saying, you know, you can't spend yourself out of recession. You know, all these phrases were coming back to me. And
I have to tell you,
it all over again. You know, we can't. And in 2 years' time, I'm going to be saying we can't spend ourselves out of the recession. You know, but it's precisely what we're trying to do.
You can spend yourself into re-election for a while.
The gentleman in question. I was just going to ask, why is the problem that the Royal Bank of Scotland bought these toxic risks or products? Surely it is a loss to the banking system, whoever owns it, RBS or somebody else.
Well, it's a loss only in the sense that it's a markdown of the value of their assets, as I understand these things. It's rather complicated, but these are assets are not actually toxic, they're not poisonous. The worst that can be said of them is that they're worthless.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they would sell. I mean, I'd buy the whole lot for a penny. I wouldn't know what to do then, actually. But sell it for tuppence. But the point is that they could be purchased. But whilst the government is saying, well, you could go bankrupt, and then the whole thing could be sold off to the various parts. The shareholders would lose everything. The depositors would get their money up to the legal limit. The useful parts would be absorbed by banks that aren't as stupid as your own, which sounds good to me. Tesco's might start becoming a bank. We all trust Tesco. Why wouldn't That's the sort of thing that might happen. But the fear of systematic failure, downward spirals, you know.
Go to David, who should have
been. I think part of that answer is true, but there is another part of the answer which I don't think can be overlooked, which is that it is inevitable that banks have friends in high places, perhaps in a way in which, for example, bus coal mine didn't. So if I were a coal miner, actually, or an ex-coal miner, which is very likely, but if I were, I'd be quite cross, because I would think, well, I was in an industry which everybody was saying to me was not worth keeping going, so it was all shut. These people in prison are not worth keeping going, and it keeps going, and billions and billions and billions are poured in. How come? Well, one possible answer, I think, is a lot of very good friends in very high places.
I feel that's the case. Though it should be said that the coal mines for many, many years were kept in a manner to which they become accustomed. I mean, they... Yeah, they weren't... you know, it would have been cheaper to give them a little bit of paper in the shape of a pick and a little bit of paper in the shape of a lump of coal, and they went home and were paid their wages. At least you wouldn't have to have all the electricity and the capital equipment and the rest of it. That would have been cheaper. Because, it's a blow to my pride. I was a strong arm walking man doing useful stuff. No you weren't, you were engaging in a hobby.
Oh, no,
paid rather well for it.
They were actually bringing coal.
Oh yes, that's what that was.
But it wouldn't have mattered if they hadn't been.
That's the point I made earlier. Most products are useful, but you should be doing something even more useful with the labour and the capital, and they weren't.
Well, yes, but the problem is that they would have been at home collecting the dough, and that would be zero use, surely. So if you look at it purely in productivity terms...
I don't advocate paying people to do nothing.
Sorry?
I don't advocate paying people to do nothing.
If we can just do it through the chair for the moment, so we can turn a number more of a general discussion. Jan and then Christian.
Gentleman over here was suggesting that there's a problem that the electorate aren't being converted. Well, are they learning nothing? The electorate don't matter at all. You have to think about the intellectuals. You have to have a critical mass of the intellectuals. Then the electorate get given it, whether it's good or bad, they get given it. But it's converting to the intellectuals that matter. And that's why we meet about what can't let anybody.
Well, Marx had an effect from lecturing in the Soho pub. Baleful effect, but... considerable, I suppose.
Christian.
Yes, going back to the information question, I think there is an information that has been censored by governments for a very long time, which is that banks may go bust. And one of the reasons that governments censored that information is that the banking system as it exists today, the fractional reserve banking system, relies on everybody being sure that the deposit we are putting into a bank is safe. So governments didn't have any incentive to say that banks may go bust. And of course now they are facing to that responsibility. But if you consider that when you buy a vacuum cleaner or an automobile or, I don't know, television set, you probably go, most people do, to a forum on the internet, or you buy a magazine that tells you that this guy is better than that guy, you know, or you ask your friends, you know, where so. But nobody who is going to put all their money in a bank is actually even asking for the balance sheet of the bank. You know, you simply go to any branch because it is on the way to your office, or because it is close to home, or because they give you something or the other. And therefore, banks didn't have any incentive to communicate on, we are, you know, this bank is solid, it is prudent, it is reliable. What it did is to say, we offer you a higher rate of interest, because that is what attracted customers. The fact that they were reliable was a given. I mean, you know, everybody said, well, this bank is because that bank is because that bank. And in order to achieve a higher rate of interest, you had to take more risk. And I think that is a big problem. And it is a censorship of information. And it not a censorship in the sense that it was... Well, actually, I think there is a law, certainly in certain countries, that will not allow you to say that this bank is going bust because it could trigger a run on this bank.
I can't believe there is such a law. What did they say about that? I mean, it's all true. I'm not. Some libertarians get awfully exercised about the idea of fractional reserve banks, and should there be some, and should it be 100% covered, therefore your bank is merely a strong hold or a strong room, but does useful things like transfers money without shifting the gold, isn't it? That kind of thing. Some insist that we shouldn't have fractional reserve. I don't think fractional reserve would be much of a problem. I get around the Rothbard criticism by saying, all right, don't call it a bank. It's an investment company. So if you put your money in this investment company, you get an interest rate, but you might lose your money. Whereas you put your money in a strong, you know, strong room, actually you might lose your money, but the chances are against it.
David McDonald was first. Then this gentleman, then David.
I'm not going to disagree with Jan's comment that the electorate don't matter. However, I'm going to add something and say the public do matter, not as voters, but they certainly do matter insofar as they form part of common sense. And common sense matters tremendously, even though I think that Russell is absolutely right to say that common sense is the metaphysics of the caveman. He's talking about current common sense. He's not talking about the common sense which the Libertarian Alliance has been set up to produce, namely the liberal common sense of the future. Hopefully of the future anyway, if this gentleman was right 20 years ago, it is of the future.
I think our future is behind us.
Right lately, then perhaps it's not going to come in the future, but certainly our aim is that common sense and changing common sense. And it is only looking at the dismal place where common sense is now to explain the Keynesian episode, the fact that Keynes was flattened by the facts, by stagflation, and yet the textbooks were not revised. If you looked at the textbooks in 1980, you still had the multiplier, the accelerator, and all the other Keynesian claptrap. And that is the reason why Keynes has come back now. Hayek means nothing because Hayek didn't change the textbooks, because Hayek didn't change common sense even in 1980, even throughout the 1980s. Thatcher was in power. Thatcher was a wonderful propagandist, even though she didn't do so much in practice in privatisation. She was a wonderful propagandist, especially on the privatisation of water, which of course hit this dismal common sense and teached it a lesson, and helped to promote our cause. But the job wasn't done on common sense. And so it's true that we need to aim at the people who are interested, the elite, the intellectuals, but in aiming at the intellectuals, we are trying to change common sense, and that is, in the long run, every man, woman as well.
It's a great deal in what you say. However, sometimes the common sense is out there. Sometimes the majority is out there, but it gets ignored. I mean, apparently, when the Democrats, well, when the Congress first questioned this TARP idea. Remember the other earlier, the one that was never carried out, that had to be done immediately. It was never carried out, but it had to be done immediately. These toxic assets had to be brought up. They thought of a figure. Well, it couldn't be a trillion, so they made it half a trillion. So they made $750 billion. But the phone calls were coming in, the emails were coming in, the letters were coming in. And someone responded by saying, well, it's divided. Half of them say no, and the other half say, hell no. In other words, the public was agin it. But the public had gone hang itself. If the two parties agree, in the short run, what are they going to do?
Before you do,
thanks.
So it's been an interesting evening.
Sounds good.
I should have left at 8 o'clock.
Oh well, I've enjoyed yourself for far too long.
What I was going to say is that the European Union, during the last 30 years, have been churning out regulation after regulation.
Indeed.
And some of them are, really bunk up regulations. I would say most of them are bunk up regulations. And the most important thing, which are the banks, which they should have tackled, they haven't. And now it's proved that the European Union are not going to form the original plan of Monnet was like a snakes and ladders game. Do it bit by bit, and we'll get more and more powerful. But their hands are tied up I'm going to set a cross-party thing for all the people that Britain now is the time to renegotiate just a purely trade agreement with them, like it or not. Because we actually no good, you know.
You don't have to negotiate things. You just
renegotiate.
You just say goodbye. Thank you very much.
Nice you.
Most of the trade will carry on because it was always because they're close and they're wealthy. That's why we trade with them. We don't do it out of kindness of heart.
£12 billion.
No, I agreed. Get out. You don't have to really. You don't have to negotiate. You simply engage in free trade. In fact, that isn't even a policy. You don't have a policy. Unlike Naomi Campbell. No, Naomi. That's about. Fine.
Naomi Campbell's the model.
No. Except for me. Naomi Klein thinks that free trade has to be imposed on people. You have to shoot them and connect their testicles to fuel generators and such like. But no, free trade is simply allowing people to do it. It would happen. Protection. It would happen spontaneously. You don't have to have a plan. You have to negotiate. The North American Free Trade Agreement should have consisted of no tariffs, no quotas, that's it. Free movement of capital and labour, possibly they won't allow that, but of capital, let's say. But it consists of 600 pages. What's that for? What's that doing? It was a kind of step by step, well, we'll do this, if you let's do that, and can this firm still do, and you might allow a bit of this, and that's not. You don't have to arrange free trade. Borders exist only so far as they're policed. I mean, they're not physically there very often, but not always. And so you don't have to renegotiate. You say
renegotiate.
No, you don't have to do it. Instead, you have to do a thing. You say, we're not going away. Good luck to you all, but we're choosing to do this with our taxes and our laws.
David Goldstone is next.
Question for you, Rob. We had the 30s and we had Keynesianism, and then we had the 70s with Keynesianism, and we've got Keynesianism now. And the question is this, do you think that when we get, say, we get a recovery in about 10 years' time, 10, 12, 15 years' time,
happy days are here again, the sky above turns clear.
Do you think that the intelligentsia will be thinking to themselves, well, that definitely shows that Keynesianism is wrong. We've tried it three times and it just hasn't worked, so that's the end of that. Or do you think that the intellectual will not learn and will not draw that conclusion at all and will draw the same conclusion that John Upright started with?
Sometimes people have a kind of image of themselves and the world they're in, the sort of person they are, and they use their intelligence to pick out the various arguments that keep them in that position. But it's not, that's an ideology. But I don't believe in ideologies in the sense that you're locked into them, you can't listen to other arguments. I mean, it's bigotry, there's impatience, there's rubbishing the opponent because he's morally inferior to you in some way, or less intelligent, or can't dance, or I mean, these silly photographs taken during the 50s in America, whereby Republicans weren't simply wrong, they were ugly, they had bat wing ears, little kooks. I mean, it's silly. I mean, we know on average that the handsomeness of Republicans will be pretty much the same as Democrats, but they wouldn't allow them simply to be wrong, they had to be weird folk as well. So I mean, we all do that a bit. We shouldn't. It's silly. We should simply follow the arguments. But to be fair, the economics profession had got shut of the Keynesianism. They'd had gone beyond it. But at the moment of crisis, the fact that everyone's read their Samuelson at university, all the economic journalists have flopped back to what, called Keynesianism. That's all they know.
The gentleman there.
Can you go first?
Are you sure? Okay. Christian?
Well, just going following on to David just said, I think that the problem with intellectuals, and from Nozick to Hayek and many others, this has been manifested, is that they will never be on the side of a free market. And therefore, Keynesian and the return of Keynesianism is something that will always appeal to the intelligentsia. And they will always be on the side of more state intervention, because that means more universities, that means more budgets for research and things like this. And they had global warming, but the crisis is even better.
Oh, yes.
So it strikes, in everybody's pocket and things like that. It's not just something which is out there, in the sky and so on. So suddenly you have the whole of intelligentsia saying, let's get, all these bankers out of the equation, and let's put everything into the hands of the state and so on. So I think you have this aspect. And the other aspect is that there isn't a feebler defender of capitalism than entrepreneurs.
Oh, yes.
So, they simply can't make their case. And very often, they don't believe in their case. So, you talk to any sort of, manager in a big corporation, any trader in Goldman Sachs and things like this, you find very few libertarians. That's why libertarianism is not very well funded. So therefore you can only have Keynesianism is the position by default. The system will always go back to Keynesian unless it goes bust.
Yes.
And I think that it's not that if we emerge from this recession in 5 or 10 years' time, it is if states simply go belly up. And then, as Marx, said, it's the change in the factors of production, it's the change in technology and so on, that puts a new system in place. But until the old system goes bust, there won't be change.
There's a deal in that. It would help if someone somewhere were doing the alternative. People are more impressed by successful practice than good theories. They'd rather see something work, like maybe in Switzerland, or maybe in Britain in the 19th century. They could say, well, look, it's powerful, it's rich. What are they doing wrong?
To have this example, you have to have had something that has changed. This example didn't fall from the sky. So it's only because, you have, at one moment, you have a number of institutions that collapse, that people are forced to change and forced to find something new. But it's not because people think that, oh, this is the concept of something new, let's apply it. But it doesn't work like this.
Well, what might happen is if there's sufficiently a crash. For example, gold might simply emerge as a default currency.
Yeah,
it's the currency you go for. That is money. It doesn't stand for anything else. That's money, and I want that, or at least I want a right to it. I may use a note, but it's going to be recoverable in that stuff. That may happen. I mean, maybe I'm a man of ideas, but you may have to have something a bit like a religious revival. Not that I want one, but a kind of moral repugnance, saying real money, our money, not yours. Our money, real money, we're going to use it. I mean, you may get some by taxation, you may not. But it's not your money supply, it's our money stock. Our sock drawer. There isn't a sock supply, well, there is in a sense, but people own socks, right? So in the same way, they will have the money. And the government, small and insignificant, will have some money, but the public will have far more money than they have. So there wouldn't be a kind of mere talk of money supply. It suggests it's got to be hosed, sluiced, valved, directed, controlled, governed. It pushes things, it turns the wheels. This is just Keynesian circles, isn't it?
There's a gentleman there, and then.
Thank you very much.
See you then.
The gentleman there gets to
turn. I'm going to say something even more pessimistic.
Oh, well.
30 or so years ago, I think I thought that unless the free market won, before there was a world government, we'd be stuffed. And this is the moment what I fear.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody wrote the book, was it on East Minus West Equals Zero?
No.
Anyway, somebody wrote a book, isn't it?
Fred Mises.
Would the Berlin Wall have fallen had the West not existed? I don't think so.
Ah! It was a point I was trying to make earlier, yes. Going to make earlier in response to the question, which is that...
So what's the whole of the world
true.
Is run by governments and is interventionist and is not free market. I'm afraid I don't see a spontaneous...
Well, the Chinese embassy...
Be, you know, Atlas Shrugged would be lovely, but it ain't going to happen.
Well, there's always somewhere may think better of it. China possibly, India possibly, somewhere else. It only has someone to be a shining example of how not to louse it up.
Yeah, but how would they be allowed to do it?
Well, there won't be a world government for a start.
In a sense, I'm making a similar point to what you're making. What makes me pessimistic about the whole thing is Gordon Brown goes on the world stage and he says, this is a global problem and it needs a global solution. That is absolute rubbish. It is not a global problem. Is a problem which exists globally because governments globally have been adopting the same wrong system. And this is what makes me pessimistic in a way.
I agree with that. As an aside, is it strange how people who are national party leaders are described as national leaders? I mean, they go abroad on some junket, they're described as world leaders. I suppose there's only one world leader. In fact, we haven't got one, but well, they're world leaders. Never underestimate the importance of a motorcade for these creeps. They love it. They love it.
David McDonald.
Yes, I'd like to disagree with Christian. I think Marx is a counterexample to himself in many ways, in more ways than one. But he didn't get the theories of surplus value from reality. He got it from his imagination. Now, we've actually had the bust, Stephen referred to it when he talked earlier on. Stagflation was Keynesianism going bust. But, as I said earlier on, it didn't revise the textbooks. Mm. And that's the reason why we've come back. So basically, it is the battle of ideas. I like the idea of Marxist materialism that we get that reality matters more than the mind. However, I think it's false, no matter how much I like it. The actual thing is the battle of ideas. Winning the battle of ideas by debate, by confronting people, by changing the intellectuals first and then changing common sense. And if we don't do that, then we will drift on. Again, this fellow says there'll come a crunch. It might be world government or some other time. We'll have lost the opportunity to make an advance. I can't imagine any such, unless asteroid comes from outer space and smashes the Earth. If we've still got some sort of despotism of world government like the Soviet Union, then liberalism has a good chance of advancing.
Mm. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
See you then.
Maybe I'm talking about one other question.
Can I respond to... I'll respond to your earlier point first, which is that with the Soviet Union, at the end, the reason it just fell so quickly... Of course, we say the Berlin Wall, it was before that, really. It was the people getting out of Germany bar. But at the end, what's the point in arresting people and trying them, imprisoning them, maybe killing them for something that you don't believe in and you're shit poor as a result, even though you're a top dog? You don't live that well. You live quite badly. What's the point? Now, it is true to say they could see that somewhere was a much better way of doing things. Now, your point would be when the dark night closes over, there's one world government. I can't see that. Then that might be attempts to have one. That would be bloodthirsty enough. Besides, we're back to the 30s. There'll be an invasion of Iran and, you know, side taking. So there won't be any world government. It's not a good. I mean, it's not a plus point.
I think you've got one more.
Oh, sorry.
Just asking a question, Christian.
Somebody said, sorry, I forgot which view it was, that the intellectuals are minded to support Keynesian ideas.
Christian, see,
because they get state funding or university funding or whatever. The thing that always amazes me is I once was an entrepreneur. I'm afraid I'm a failed one. But I know a lot of business people who are not funded by the state in any way whatsoever, and they are still socialists. This is the bit that I do not understand. You know, people who live by the free market, who, you know, make their money and their friends and everything by the free market, they're still old socialists.
Why?
Because they're nice people. And the market, at best, is amoral. It might turn out the stuff, but at best it's amoral. And very often it's simply immoral. because it's predatory and it poisons you.
I'm being
okay, well, we've probably got about time to about 5 or 10 more questions. Have you got another one?
I'd like to quote Homer Simpson at this point. Sorry.
Do you want to have a go?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
I'm curious about the pessimism that these two gentlemen have displayed. Perhaps we should welcome it. Unfortunately, I mean, the situation we have now is often described as a problem of confidence. Yet, unfortunately, the confidence remains in government as being the solution. So do you think there'll come a time when the pessimism will get to such a stage where governments will simply give up feeding people all this nonsense of them being able to solve the problem, and people just give up on government being a solution and wait for time to take its place in the market to do its job? Mm.
Yes, it would help to have ideas about saying how it will happen, but the ideas are actually there. They're already there and in the neglected textbooks, but they are there.
So could we not promote
everything I say is it's from somewhere else.
So could we not promote confidence? I mean, a lot of people are, as from people I've spoken to, it's the fear of the unknown. It's sort of, so should we not just tell them how bad this really is? So
well, yes, but
we're in the shit.
It could be. I mean, governments could make it quite bad. They can make it quite deep. They can make it quite prolonged. But unless they go to war as well, the worst it's going to be is that you'll be unemployed and better off than someone in 1928.
Don't forget the
Or 1952, for that matter.
Oh!
I if we have time, I will do all this.
Christian's got
yes.
a point.
I think you're making the point that I wanted to make earlier. I mean, if you are, as Jessamine was saying, people are turning to governments and so on. Now, I don't vote, but I mean, but people vote for government. They pay taxes to a government. They have a leader of this government that comes on television and says, I can't do anything. I need to get 20 other heads of state to sit with me and solve this problem. Maybe, maybe not, because we are not all in agreement and we'll have to have preliminary meetings and things like that. Now, if you think about it, you say, well, hang on, why am I paying you? Why am I paying all these taxes? I mean, you are declaring, I can't do anything for you guys. You know, so I think that is, already hitting people on the head, and it is slowly sinking in. And I think we will see more and more of these sort of failed meetings that, can't come to a conclusion and so on, because it's very difficult to get 20 countries as different as China, Brazil, and India, and France, and so on, to come with a solution. So more and more, I think people will realize, well, if it doesn't work, if these people can't take us out of that mess, why don't we try ourselves? And as you say, I mean, gold will be, or could be, I don't know if it's gold or something else, but people will start finding ways around government. And it is not that you destroy the old order, it's that it becomes irrelevant. As kings, in the 17th century, kings where you couldn't imagine a country without a king. Today, in this country, and 10 others in Europe and elsewhere, you have kings. They haven't gone, but they have become irrelevant.
Decorative.
That's right.
Pretty much, yes. Oh, there is that. Also, people, as I said earlier on, last October, when it was, that it's sometimes said as if recent prosperity was a mirage. It was got up. It was smoke and mirrors. It wasn't there. Well, no. The output was the output was the output. What was consumed was made.
Mm.
I mean, it was a far greater amount than humankind has ever known. Let's not get too miserable about this. We support each other. The government is on our shoulders. It doesn't help us out of anything. We keep it.
Mm.
So, why can't we just look out? Why can't we just buy and sell? Why can't we just produce? Eventually, that might seem to be an answer.
Steve Berry from Mighty Wild Thing.
I mean, I don't want to be pessimistic. I think that Keynesianism will fail again. But the sad thing is, it takes time. I mean, I'm reading Hazlitt on Keynes at the moment, and he says that he thinks that the ready acceptance of Keynes in America, Alvin Hansen, and speech was taken up, he thinks that Keynes was for the 20th century what Capital was for the 19th century. You know, it was that big. And it will just take time. I think it'll fail again, and then people will be very wary of it. You know, it failed in the 70s, didn't it? I mean, someone said it failed in the 30s. I don't think it...
Actually, it wasn't tried in the 30s, to be fair to it.
The thing wasn't written until 36, for God's sake. Yeah. So we can't really... blame the 29 recession on Keynes, but the fact that the 70s was such an unpleasant experience, and we're going to repeat all that, I think this time it really will be home.
The next in order is Jan.
I have a similar response to David's to Christian concerning the irrelevance of there being any dramatic phenomena that are necessary in order to refute people's existing theories. All observations are theory laden. They're just a gestalt switch, and when anybody in this room is a libertarian, probably, you know, they say, well, instead of looking at it this way, look at it that way. Doesn't it make more sense? Yes, and that's how the switch took place. Nothing suddenly happened in the economy that made us change. So why would we expect that to be necessary?
Is that the shift from the Ptolemaic to the Copernican?
Yeah.
I mean, everything was still the same old act in the sky.
It's purely intellectual, wasn't it? Yes. New empirical data.
So there had to be problems, or rather, far better solutions at least.
There's certainly problems.
Yes. With the empirical. Oh, yeah.
David Goldstone was waiting there.
Yeah, I know. Go on. The problem I see is that it won't fail, it will succeed, because in 10 years' time there will be the glimmerings of a recovery after 10 years of intervention. It would have succeeded. All the intervention and all the billions of this and billions of that and the inflation and the we would have eventually recovered.
If you want to be really miserable, it's been argued that the even though good economists in America point out that FDR failed. I mean, it just failed. It didn't recover. It didn't even recover with the war. I mean, the unemployment rate went down because the unemployed were in uniform getting killed. But nothing really. The value turnout of the economy didn't really boom until about 47, 48. And that amazingly was when they came back, there was no plan, and the state cut expenditure enormously. Mm. It should have been appalling. And it was the utter refutation of Keynesianism. And silence. Utter silence. It didn't stop Keynesianism at all in the schools, because it was a lovely theory, and it meant you could elbow aside your duff old professor, you could get on, you could feel superior. Oh, was it? So the events don't always...
events don't matter at all.
Well, they can motivate you to try and find a...
Oh, yes, they can motivate the person...
To try and think about it.
They motivate us and depress us and get us out to argue, but they don't, there's not going to be no external crucial event that's going to help us. We've just got to get on with the battle of ideas.
What crucial event?
A couple of other people, just in line, gentleman there.
Yes, could one actually say that in a sense that Keynesianism is succeeding at the moment, in that when you have a drop in income, the multiplier effect may apply when you try and have an increase in income, that definitely seems to be applying when you have a drop in income. And the less people save, that multiplier effect is amplified.
It's true to say, but this is simply Say's law. I gave a talk on it the other year. That this was understood that the real multiplier is output. Mm. If you make more with the same, or even more with less, of value, some new technology, some new capital, some new methods, means that the costs fall here, which means that things that previously were unprofitable now become profitable. Not too expensive to buy, now become cheap enough to buy, that makes for the profits. So the real multiplier is people at work turning stuff out and saving. Not the paradox of saving, not the paradox of thrift, but actual saving is good. We need firms to grow, not the opposite. We need interest rates. Why is there a czar of interest rates? You don't get a price of oil czar. Well, they tried to have one, but they can't do it. But when it comes to the interest rates, should the market set it? Oh, no, we have to steer the economy. And Ipswich. Yes, well, they've steered the economy head on into the fourth oncoming traffic by the look of it. But But as regards the idea that there can be a collapse in demand, there certainly can be a collapse in demand. But one of the things, in fact, possibly the only thing that makes it inevitable, or rather makes it happen, is paying people to engage in job search, knowing that they won't find anything, and wait for the good times to return. In other words, if people were obliged to be adaptable, I don't like the fact that people have to shift location, take a pay cut, learn a new skill, whatever it might be. I don't like it. But as we've low interest rates, artificially low interest rates, gone into a cul-de-sac, as it were, we have to back out, write off some capital, shift some labour, do what it takes. So it's not so much as the cause of the depression is a fall in output. That is the depression. Why is it fallen? Because it couldn't carry on profitably where it was. It's got to do something else. The Keynesians and the Marxists think, no, the only problem was it was a sudden spook. The investors got spooked. They wouldn't carry on investing at the same rate. People wouldn't carry on spending at the same rate on the same old stuff. We don't have to move anything. Just get the spending back up again. Get the confidence back up again to the investors. And we'll invest in the same things in the same way. And it will... No. The pattern was wrong. The spread was wrong. This is the Austrian theory of the trade cycle. So you've got to, for a while, to damp down, but it won't collapse to nothing. You know, people still want to eat, drink, wear clothes and the rest of it. So there will be sufficient demand to stop things collapsing to nothing, but then people really have to just take wage cuts, move house, whatever it might be. This isn't helped by the minimum wage at all. This isn't helped by planning controls over cities growing, cities declining. Of course it isn't helped.
Thank you. We'll ask our failed entrepreneur to make the last point, and then we'll go.
Well, the point was being made that there's a danger that what is being done might be seen to succeed. And that reminded me of something, and if you'll indulge me, I'm going to tell you a very short joke.
Cool.
Two men in a train, let's make this train sort of Poirot time, and so to speak. Two men in a train, sitting opposite each other, don't stiff up a little bit. And one of them starts tearing up a newspaper and throwing this newspaper out the window. And the other chap sort of sits there, you know, my business. Eventually, he's overcome with curiosity. So he says to the other man, excuse me, you know, why did you throw this newspaper out of the window? Bear in mind, this train is trapped in the sun. And the chap says, well, to keep the elephants away. And the other man says, but there aren't any elephants. No, it's very effective. This is what government did all the time. Oh, well, if we hadn't done this, it would be even worse. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Preserved for posterity, but not prosperity. I was singing Happy Days Are Here Again because that was the FDR campaign song, you may know.
You got it on that one?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I hope. It's recording.
You want to talk next month, David?
I'm trying to get Andrew.